It's a mini episode.
Hello and welcome to another mini You Gotta Check This Out with Mike and Dre. I'm the Mike, and we'll be presenting you with a side discussion from the episode every other week like this. Or, if we got nothing, I'll just subject y'all to another music demo. We'll see how it goes. This week, Dre and I discuss 90s DVD menus and J. Michael Straczynski's pre-Babylon 5 career. We begin with Dre in the middle of wishing to keep this a Babylon 5 podcast forever.
And who knows, by the time we're at the end, we might be a Babylon 5 show just forever. But, you know, if that happens, that means good things, right? That means it's too successful for our own good. And I'm not going to complain if that happens.
Yeah, if we had to spin off our own show that we started from the show that we started because it became something about the first show we started, then we're doing good. It's a good problem to have.
And what is actually making me laugh right now with how my life is going is I've run into this actually exact same scenario with a few shows. I've done it with Suits where I was like interested, but I'm like, I don't have it in me to watch 7 series. And I'm actually doing it now with Shameless. I found someone who's like recapped a bunch of Shameless. I'm like, man, I really want to know what happened on Shameless. I don't want to just read the recaps, but I also don't want to watch the whole show. So we're kind of doing that, not to the same degree, but Babylon.
Oh, well, it's like I almost have to have a podcast to get into a show that I can't. I'm doing Supernatural right now.
Gainfully unemployed
podcast too.
So you're watching along?
It's a nice pace. It just so happens that my wife, Karen, 3 or 4 months ago, ordered as many seasons as on Blu-ray as she could and watched through most of the series. So I just happen to have most of the series lying around on DVD and Blu-ray.
That is definitely nice. And for what it's worth, so again, to keep saying the show, Babylon 5, the Blu-ray was released. It's about $50, and I might pick it up because I have a bunch of the DVDs, but my older DVDs, some of them gotten scratched. There were director's commentaries for season 1 that I was able to watch through.
I have been using the library. I'm down in Chicago. There's a huge library system. They have a few different copies of the DVDs floating around. It's been a great way for me to catch up on it without having to subscribe to Amazon, because that's the other main way to get the whole Babylon 5 series on streaming.
It is available on Amazon. The full Blu-ray set is about $50. I think I saw that. And then what you were saying, one awesome aspect of the DVDs, if you go the library route or like me, I have them in my own collection. As I mentioned, they're starting to degrade because I've watched them so much, is the DVD titles. Oh my gosh, this is another thing of the past, which people may not know what we're talking about. It used to be the case, if you bought television shows on digital video disc, I think that's what that's short for, right? They would have animated intro menus that were doing all sorts of things. And the Babylon 5 ones have these weird morphing effects where characters morph into other characters.
Yes. Did you see? As soon as I saw that, I sent you a video of that. That struck me. It was the weirdest like 90s-ish DVD thing I've seen since, well, the 90s.
Yeah. No, I mean, there were, you know, intros that looked like third person shooters, right? They would do that. There would be different sorts of animation, play clips of the show. You know, it was a wild time. The DVD era was a wild time. All right. So J. Michael Straczynski is more prolific than you think, even if you're a fan. If you're a mega fan, you know, but if you're just a cursory fan, like I was back in the day, it is shocking. And we could fill an entire episode on it, Mike, but I figure for this one, we just kind of want to do a little like how he got here. And what we're kind of pulling from is his book. It's called Becoming Superman, which talks a lot about his early life. He had a crazy life before he even got into writing and then became a prolific writer and just worked on like so much stuff. He worked on He-Man. He is the co-creator of She-Ra, and he knows so much about creator rights. A big thing that you put in the notes is he was one of the first creators that was probably known to have major fan interactions. He would go on message boards. There are
Usenets early on.
There's like the JMS archive. JMSnews.com has an archive of all of his older interactions on the internet, which is just absolutely wild. So you don't even have to go like to archive.org. You can see all of the stuff he did. And there's a little table at the bottom of JMSnews.com that just showed how many times he was posting over the years. And so in the 90s, when Babylon 5 was going strong, he was posting hundreds of posts a month. Heck, in 96, between April and May, over 600 posts a month, like when Babylon 5 was right in the middle of its heyday.
Oh, yeah. He was interacting with fans right through all those from the early beginnings. This was, what, early 90s when it started? We're talking like 93 through 97. So this was, yeah, the early Usenet groups. He was on back and forth, just getting feedback and talking to fans through all these posts.
Well, even stuff, a kind of an apocryphal story, I think he says on one of the DVD commentaries is that season one of Babylon 5 didn't get any nominations for, I believe, like the Nebulas, because those require like a consolidation of votes. So for season twos and three, he basically went, you all need to get together. Yeah, this show was awesome, but you need to actually decide which episodes you want. There are other fun stories about his interaction with fans, which lead to other fun topics. Namely, he notes very quickly nowadays. He was active on Twitter and X. I think he's still active on Blue Sky, but he'll note very quickly, he cannot solicit ideas. Do not ping J. Michael Straczynski saying, I've got an idea for a Babylon 5 reboot. He will just block you immediately. And back in the day, that actually happened. He had an idea for a story that he was going to do in, I believe, season two of Babylon 5 or season one. And someone suggested it. And what he did go do is he did interact with that fan, made sure that they were on the same page, and then actually released the episode. But he is very cognizant of the fact that, hey, if you solicit ideas to him, he can't use them without opening himself to legal issues. And that's a very sad state of the world.
Yeah, you guys talked about that a lot on the Nerded episode with Michael Vincent Bramley.
Which, it's because what's funny is JMS was my counterexample, because for those that know, MVB, Michael Vincent Bramley, just another three-letter awesome artist who is way too talented for his own good. He pitched an idea for Once Upon a Deadpool that actually ended up getting used. And he kind of joked about it. And after the fact was kind of told by, you know, people who know everything after the fact that, hey, you can't solicit ideas, etc. And my counter was like, JMS and Kevin Smith are two people who have had people pitch them ideas and then have actually found a way to get them made and get that person credit. But it is so much more work, and studios hate that, because spoiler alert, studios hate to share credit and money with creators if they don't have to. A subject near and dear to JMS's heart. Crazy life, Reed becoming Superman, amazing backstory. And then just became a workhorse in Hollywood everywhere. Wrote for, tell me what I'm missing. He wrote for The Real Ghostbusters, He-Man and She-Ra, Beauty and the Beast, I think you said, Murder, She Wrote.
Yep. Twilight Zone was a big one. A lot of sci-fi, like television specials he did around that time.
Yeah, got really ingratiated with Harlan Ellison. You brought up, you put that in the notes, right? He is the executor of Harlan Ellison's estate. Does a lot for that.
A lot of his early stuff was all through journalism, too. Like, he had done a lot. He's a writer for the LA Times, just a regular journalist. He had done that all through college. So he came up just writing all the time.
Wrote for everything, everywhere, everyone, gets into television. And then with He-Man and She-Ra, he gets tasked with co-creating She-Ra. And actually, what I'm going to try and do in the background subtly,
well, that was before that. Like, even there was a whole part in his book, because he was talking about getting stuck towards the end of Murder, She Wrote, because he was becoming like one of the head writers on there. Everybody knew the series was going to end and had trouble getting anything else. And he keeps talking about periods in his life where, in order to continue as a writer, he had to jump ship from whatever genre he was working on or whatever vertical of writing, be it television, be it being journalism, be it just like doing his talk show. And in this case, the He-Man thing was a blind jump where he wrote a spec script and just handed it in to somebody he knew through somebody at the television studio. And he ended up getting work on He-Man that way. But it was like some of that blind stuff just doesn't happen anymore. But it's been a common occurrence throughout his writer's career that he's taken these huge leaps. We may not talk about this episode, but his leap to do Changeling later on, writing for Clint Eastwood,
which was probably the biggest thing,
was a major step up for his career.
It's funny how much everything builds, right? Because as a writer, you use everything. So much of what is in Babylon 5 is on his life. So again, go read Becoming Superman and you will see just how much of his real life he pulls into the show. Changeling was like a story he found as a journalist. And he was just like, this is really fascinating. I'm going to do something with it. And it's a true story with, Clint Eastwood, Angelina Jolie, and probably like the biggest thing, like that was his biggest hit. Because the other thing he's well-versed in, and I think is really important to bring up with Babylon 5, is the creator rights, how much creators actually get. Like, you can make one of the most impressive things out there. And you're like, oh, that person has to be making money. And we're seeing this nowadays, modern day Marvel legends, where it's like, oh, this person made all of your favorite Marvel characters. I'm not talking Stan Lee. I'm talking other like writers and artists. And it's like, oh, and you discover that they needed to make a GoFundMe for $11,000 in doctor bills right after we find.
Well, for a lot more on this, we go into this on the Youngblood episode of Nerd that you should all check out.
I see what I'm
doing, Dre?
You're plugging the back catalog, and then that means Mike's going to get drunk, which is an inside joke to the Nerd episode. So, you know, it's we're going in circles here.
Anyway, you're talking about going into She-Ra.
Oh, yeah. Basically, and Youngblood, we're talking about how creators don't necessarily get the money and recognition. And so, like I said, the two major ones for me with JMS are he co-creates She-Ra with Larry DiTilio. I hope I'm saying that right. Apologies, Larry, if I'm mispronouncing it. He is no longer with us. Rest in peace. And they don't want to give them co-credit. They're like, hey, can you just say we co-create this? And they're like, absolutely not, because if we do that, we might have to pay you. And that is the common MO. Major studios don't want to give credit, because if they give credit, they might have to pay you. And they don't like paying, even though it would be a pittance. So he also does Babylon 5, which he comes with this 5-year arc. As we noted on the last episode about Infection that you brought up, JMS had two ideas. He had like smugglers at a spaceport and this overarching almost Game of Thrones before Game of Thrones intrigue across multiple alien races. And then he went,
and he didn't know how to sell the giant idea because he wanted to bring it to television and knew it could work as a novel told over multiple seasons. But there was nothing like that in television. He had to figure out how to sell that idea. The smugglers is what brought it to him. He's like, well, the smugglers, a show that he was kind of working on in the background of his mind, all had to take place in one location. So that was the genius spark of like, let's combine those two ideas together so that you could package up the giant space opera in a setting that would work to tell the stories you would want to tell. And you could still sell as like, well, it's one location. That's all you got to pay
Absolutely
for.
Absolutely genius. Gets that idea and he pitches it to multiple studios, Star Trek and WB, who was making their own. I think you have it written. It was PTEN, right? I think is what you have written in the notes.
PTEN, that was a fledgling network. They wanted to be the fifth network after Fox came out to get in with it, you know, with the main ones.
Yeah, so WB comes up with their own network. They need content, kind of like sci-fi before sci-fi or SIFI or however you say it nowadays. So they come up with their network. He pitches to them. He pitches to Star Trek. Star Trek says, no, we don't want it. Paramount says, no, we don't want your idea. That's fine. WB says, let's take a chance on it. They release a 2-hour made-for-TV movie, which I have watched. I have watched it too.
It's not great,
but it's there. Yeah, but it was enough for them to greenlit.
It's a TV movie.
It was enough for them to greenlit. I mean, it probably speaks the time too, because it doesn't age well, but that's because I'm used to modern era. Star Trek, though, goes out and makes Deep Space Nine and uses the same Bible. Some of the characters have the same name, the same idea. You know, it's not the Membarian Earthers, but it's the Romulans and the Federation in neutral space. The same kind of overarching character arc with the main character, I believe, follows very similarly. I have not watched Deep Space Nine, in part because of loyalty to Babylon 5, in part because I was kind of Star Trek'd out at that point. But it would be very interesting. So JMS pitched this to multiple networks. They both make it. And that's the other kind of creator right thing, which is WB says, let this lawsuit go, because if you go ahead with this lawsuit, you might make a little money, but neither show gets made. Both shows are going to get shut down if you go ahead with this lawsuit, is kind of what I've heard after the fact and like after the fact thing. So basically, Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine both go on the air. They kind of compete with each other. It was weird. You noted this, that Babylon 5's pilot releases first, but Deep Space Nine gets greenlit before Babylon 5. So Babylon 5 winds up looking like a Deep Space Nine knockoff, even though it came first. And then we wind up even funnier territories where JMS, at the end of all of this, it's in Becoming Superman, people at WB that do not like the show, PTN goes under, Babylon 5 gets sold to TNT, Turner doesn't like the show, and so now the people that have all the control of the rights of Babylon 5 don't like or don't want to make more Babylon 5, which means JMS has this really hilarious creator rights era of create She-Ra, doesn't get any credit for it. Creates Babylon 5, has to let someone else make it and make the big successful show that he's not on, because if he wants to make his show, he has to let that go. The show he makes, the credit or the proprietary rights get bounced around to enough people that don't want to make it, and JMS ends up at the end making some of the most prolific science fiction that he didn't make a lot of money for and isn't allowed to make anymore. Man, JMS is just a name to learn about creator rights. If there's someone to talk to about creator rights, JMS is the person to talk to.
And time. All right. That was a good rant. I really like that one, Dre.
Anything else you want to add on the, you know, like I said, we could do an entire episode on JMS.
My memories of all these shows that he worked on, the real Ghostbusters, He-Man, and She-Ra were all early cartoon favorites of mine, like as they were coming out on Saturday mornings and then in syndication. Like, I remember a vivid memory in first grade where I had to do a presentation on my favorite show, and it was She-Ra at the time. And I brought in this thing, She-Ra, and I would just remember like kids making fun of me because like boys don't watch She-Ra. It's like, it's good, I like it. I didn't know at the time. I wasn't able to say at the time, J. Michael Straczynski wrote it. He's going to bring up Babylon 5 to you, and you'll see one day, kids.
He is seminal in the MCU, right? Did the Thor that created the Chris Hemsworth Thor, some of the best Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah. My introduction to him was Rising Stars when I was collecting comics in the mid-2000s, and that's when he got his big break into independent comics. So, yeah, I was reading his early on at that point, too. But, yeah, like, I remember Captain Power. Did you ever, were you probably too young for Captain Power?
I remember Earth, Wind, Fire, Heart. It's like, you know, it's like precursor to Avatar, but with Heart too.
I never had Captain Power, but that was the toy I lusted after when I was like 9 years old. Cause like, wow, you could get the toy and it interacts with the TV. And that was J. Michael Straczynski writing all the scripts for that show. Okay,
that was actually a blind spot to me, even reading all the stuff, the Captain Power. And I think he mentions that in Becoming Superman, but there's just so much in that book.
But yeah, Captain, so it was like, did you know about this? It was like laser tag. And they would have screens in between things that would happen on the show that you could interact and get points for by pointing the gun and shooting things on the screen. It would save it in your gun, and you would get extra points if you had done that with the show and could play it with your friends. It's like the next level. Let's not just sell them the toys with the Transformers and the G.I. Joes. Let's actually make it so they have to watch our show and see our sponsors to interact with the toys more. It never worked out, but it was like, for me, it was catnip.
So fascinating, a number of things that were literally just ahead of their time. Even if you look at Babylon 5, you think of Babylon 5 being made in the 90s and going, oh, give it, if we could have had this in the 2000s, what could it have been? And then by that time, the rights are so bifurcated and the creators are so disenfranchised, but it is what it is. Okay, by the way, I'll let you get the last word on JMS. Look them up more, people.
Yeah, not too much more on JMS. In fact, I kind of like to save a lot of JMS talk to leave this one as, you know, end it with JMS with where he started Babylon 5. And then maybe we can pick up later and talk another episode about where he went to, like, especially with his comics. Because, you know, he, like, as you were saying, he's written for MCU, but that became because he was writing for Thor at the time. He's written some key issues and storylines for Spider-Man, for better or for worse, some of the most hated and best loved issues of Spider-Man. JMS has been there for
it. I have an episode that I know we're going to have to do. I'm sorry, it may have to be bonus content, but there is a future episode that I think is going that we will be able to pair and marry with, I think it's Die Another Day, is the Spider-Man episode. Future content, we'll take a pin in that. You know what we'll do, Mike? It's basically like we will leave a breadcrumb of something that'll happen 3 years in the future.
And that's where Dre passed out in the middle of a sentence. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week to discuss Babylon 5, Season 1, Episode 13, Signs and Portents, with special guest Karen Slater. Cheers, all.